Hey everyone, my name's Chris Mitzloff, and I'm here with Matthew Griffin. And today we're doing our first project or our first podcast for the Mentor Project. And the purpose of this particular podcast is to discuss things around power generation and power storage and where that happens to be moving in the world today. You know, everything we're with the electric cars and all the additional power requirements that we're starting to generate within the world, we need to find a more efficient way to do those things. And I think there's a lot of green technologies out there that could be beneficial. And I know that a lot of that is improving day over day. And so Matthew actually has a lot of experience in these fields. And so Matt, sorry, if you prefer Matt or Matthew, I don't know. So
I'm fine with Matt, Chris.
Okay, perfect. So during a talk that I saw with you, you had discussed some of the new technologies around solar. Let's just start there with solar. I know one of the challenges that we've had with solar has been the efficiency of solar. What kinds of things have you seen that has started to improve that?
So it's a good question. So there's a whole variety of different improvements that are now starting to come through. So if you go down to your local Home Depot, basically, and pick a solar panel, basically, out of the racks, typically it's going to be a silicon-based solar panel, and that's going to be about 17% energy efficient. So what we mean by energy efficiency with solar is for every single photon of light in a traditional sort of off-the-shelf solar panel, it will kick off 0.17 of an electron. So that's where 0.17 equates to 17% energy efficiency.
Okay.
Now, when you have a look at those solar panels, for example, basically, if you're living in Florida, those types of solar panels basically are superb. You can run your home on them 24/7. You can then obviously run your car on them 24/7 as well, thanks to tide grid storage and lithium-ion battery packs basically on the walls and. So that's all good. But as soon as you get into sort of areas like the ones that I'm in, so London, basically, where typically it's overcast, we have something called rain and fog and all these other kinds of beautiful things. Those solar panels just don't make economic sense because they can't generate enough electricity to keep our houses going unless you literally cover your roof in them.
Right.
So as a consequence, when you have a look at a lot of the different technologies that are now starting to come through, and a lot of analysts tend to sort of question basically whether or not solar can really take fossil fuels to town, for example, we've got a stunning roadmap. We've got stunning prototypes, and we have a stunning roadmap ahead of us already. So I'll give you some examples. So in the labs over in Japan, we have perovskite solar panels basically that can be 3D printed. They have a 32% efficiency. At 32% efficiency, the cost of electricity generation is pretty much zero. So when we get to that level, we are literally talking about changing the fundamental economics of energy generation and pushing it to zero. Once we start moving beyond 32% energy efficiency, basically we have bacteria-based solar panels, basically which are able to get up to about 50% energy efficiency. We've got the US Department of Energy have just produced a solar concentrator, which is 48% efficient. So that's actually a product. In addition to that, we have something called black silicon, again, out of the US. Now, black silicon is relatively unique, basically in the fact that it can push energy efficiencies for solar panels, traditional silicon solar panels, using this technology called black silicon, up to 132%. So, wow. And the reason why it's 132%, and the reason why I gave the photon explain at the start, was because for every single photon that hits black silicon, it kicks off 1.32 electrons as opposed to the 0.17 that we have today. In addition to that, when we start having a look at some of the other sort of rather strange things that we can do with solar panels, we can use 3D printing and we can print a material called a nanophotonic material, because different wavelengths of light basically are, some are long, some are short. Some of the most energy efficient wavelengths of light are the short ones. So you need to be able to create a material that can catch light at that type of very short wavelength. So nanophotonic materials all of a sudden will push us to about 40%. If you take a traditional solar panel, just a bog standard Home Depot solar panel, and you put a layer of graphene over the top of it, when it rains, you can generate electricity from rain. When it snows, you can generate electricity from snow. Using these nanophotonic materials as well, you can create a solar panel that generates electricity almost in pitch black darkness. So, and at that point, we aren't even talking about solar panels, because what are they? You know, lunar panels? I mean, you know,
here we go.
If you use another type of technology called carbon nanotubes, and these are, you can think of these as very, very tiny shoelaces at the nanoscale that look like carbon sort of shoelaces, they will capture the heat within the solar panel. And that will then give you a traditional silicon-based solar panel that has an 80% efficiency. So just to kind of reiterate, today it's 17%. The world record breaking silicon solar panel is typically 22%. Perscovite gets us to 32%. Bacteria based solar panels get us to 48 and 50% efficiency. Silicon based solar panels, especially with carbon nanotubes in them that recapture heat, takes us to 80% efficiency. And if you use black silicon, 132% efficiency. And then you start doing all these other sort of funky things, basically about, you know, putting graphene on the top of a solar panel and everything else. And you've got solar panels that work in cloudy conditions, rainy conditions, fog at night, et cetera, et cetera. At which point, what we've just explained there is the complete and absolute death of the fossil fuel economy. And then furthermore, when we start having a look at how solar panels are constructed, you can get flexible solar panels. So these are materials that bend. We have transparent solar panels now. So you can create electricity generating windows for skyscrapers. And then in addition to that, we're now starting to use artificial intelligence to help us design spray-on solar. So it's not really a panel, but spray-on solar, which would then allow you to coat almost any and every object with a silicon coating or a photovoltaic coating. And at that point, as we've kind of seen with Toyota, Hyundai, Lightyear One, who are using sort of flexible photovoltaic materials, you end up with an electric car that no longer needs batteries, never needs to be plugged in. And those three companies there have already produced a fully commercial PV car no longer uses lithium ion batteries, in which case we're now starting to disrupt the lithium ion industry or the battery industry. We no longer need superchargers. You no longer need to plug your car in. We've disrupted the transportation industry. We've also dropped the cost of manufacturing things like Teslas down from, say, $60,000 for a Model 3 down to around $20,000 to $25,000, because in a Tesla Model 3, as well as the Xs and the larger ones, about two-thirds of the car's cost is actually lithium-ion batteries.
Wow. So and probably a lot of that is weight as well from the batteries. Yeah, so absolutely. I would imagine it's going to make them a lot more lighter, which is going to make them more efficient as well.
Yeah. Which so. Then, yeah. So what you have is you have a car basically with an unlimited range that never needs plugging in. In addition to that, when you start putting in some new wireless energy technologies into, say, that car, that car can generate, using its photovoltaic materials, can generate more electricity than it uses, and then can transmit that energy wirelessly to the trucks around it. So this is peer-to-peer vehicle charging. It could transmit it to other local energy infrastructure. You fundamentally change the global energy infrastructure and industry space.
Yeah, that's amazing. So, you know, a lot of these technologies that you're mentioning, when do you see those becoming commercially affordable, I guess? Because I imagine at this point in time, they're probably out of range for someone like you or I to buy. unless you're doing way better than I am. But, I think that there's probably a lot of R&D money that went into that. So what's kind of your thought on when that might be commercially viable?
You're absolutely right. So what we have today basically is those panels basically at Home Depot, basically, you know, they work, they're reliable, they're safe, they're tested, they integrate into your home's electricity system and network and grid and what have you. But fundamentally, they're accessible because they're on the shelves that you can go and pick them up off, and they're affordable. So for any new technology to start getting market traction, it's got to be affordable, accessible, you know, reliable, safe, regulated. You know, the insurers have got to have a look over it as well to make sure that they're not going to catch fire and they're happy to insure you still, basically, if you've got these solar panels on your roof and so on and so forth. As we saw with some of the panels, basically, that were breaking out in flames, basically, with SolarCity and Walmart, you know, you've got to tick lots and lots of boxes before these types of newer technologies eventually hit our shelves and get put onto our roofs and things. So to answer your question, though, we're managing to develop products faster than ever before. So Toyota, for example, used an artificial intelligence to help them design a new type of lithium ion electric vehicle battery. Normally that would take 2 years. It took them 16 days, including testing. So typically, with most of these technologies, the prices are falling very, very rapidly. But then we've got to be able to scale the technology, and it's that manufacturing lag, basically, that sort of often kicks in. So really, you're looking at about 10 years. But what we have seen is as more people become interested in new types of electricity generation, you know, whether it's wind, whether it's solar, whether it's small nuclear, whatever it happens to be, what naturally happens, basically, is investors follow. So as we saw with Tesla, you know, if you have a look at Tesla, Tesla has kicked off an electric vehicle revolution. If you are going to switch the world's transportation system to electric, you need batteries. Investors have come in. They've poured hundreds of billions of dollars, basically, into energy research and development. So that's kicked off a sort of a new cold war, basically, as it will, when it comes to trying to sort of be top dog to develop these new things. But in Tesla's case, because they developed a good battery, investors then came in and started investing more and more in battery technology and battery development. The energy density of those batteries is now getting much, much better, which all of a sudden now gives us an on-ramp to electric aircraft. And the first electric aircraft should really have started flying in about 2035. They flew last year. So when you start bringing all these different factors together, the vast majority, because we are trying to flip the world's energy system from, you know, greenhouse gas emitting, you know, nasties to greener, sort of more sustainable, renewable solutions, these things should start commercializing in about 5 years' time. So from 2025 onwards, you'll start seeing a much, much broader energy mix. But traditionally, these technologies would have taken 20 to 30 years to commercialize. And when you have a look at, ironically, but when you have a look at the world's first electric car, the world's first electric car was produced, including the charging station, in 1912.
Wow.
And there's nothing like a societal revolution, basically, to bring about change.
Right. I, you know, do you think a lot of the death of that back in the day was because of the oil industry and that sort of thing? Or do you think it just wasn't, they didn't have the efficiency really needed to surpass what gas could do?
So, I mean, even in the UK, basically in the 1960s, we actually had electric vehicles that you could just plug into a 3-pin socket here. And they were very small vehicles, you know, don't get me wrong. Yeah, they were sort of a bit larger than a motorbike kind of thing. You know, we'd take them for toys today, but they still had a 30-mile range. So when you have a look at, you know, when you have a look at the reason why these technologies were delayed, there's numerous reasons. So firstly, the oil and gas industry are fantastic lobbyists. And they want to protect that status quo. Secondly, basically, when you have a look at governments, the fact of the matter is that the vast majority of governments get a huge amount of tax revenues basically from the oil and gas industry. So you don't really want to turn that off all of a sudden. Thirdly, when you have a look at the automotive manufacturers, you know, if you were the CEO basically of Ford, for example, and someone came to you and said, I think that we should stop making combustion engine vehicles and we should make electric vehicles, the CEO of Ford at the time would say, are you crazy? We've invested over the years, we've invested $100 billion or whatever the silly amount would be, trying to create the best combustion engine possible. And you just want us to what? Throw that all away? You know, what do we do with that? Put it on the scrap heap. And when you actually have a look at disruption, the vast majority of disruption that we see today is actually coming from people who sat outside of specific industries. You know, if you have a look at autonomous vehicles, for example, it's not Chrysler or Chrysler, GM or Ford, et cetera, et cetera, or Volkswagen, you know, who started disrupting that space. It's Google, the search company. When you have a look at who kicked off the electric car revolution, it's Tesla. You know, and Elon Musk is ex-PayPal, you know. And then similarly, basically, when you start having a look at a lot of other areas, you know, even space, you know, the space industry was not disrupted by Lockheed Martin or the ULA Alliance. They were disrupted by, again, in that case, you know, Elon Musk, someone from outside of the industry. So a lot of industries that we see being disrupted today are typically being disrupted from people outside of the industry. Finance and banking, you know, it's fintechs. It's people who used to live in the finance and banking world, got fed up of it, thought they could do better, came out of it, and then did better.
Right.
And this is where companies like Venmo basically obviously sort of start coming in. And it's crazy. And even in the connectivity space, you know, when you have a look at AT&T, Verizon, those kinds of guys, they're rolling out 5G. They're spending or will have to spend tens of billions of dollars rolling out 5G across continental USA. And again, you've got Elon Musk, who's just throwing 12,000 low Earth orbit satellites into space to beam internet connectivity from space.
Right.
And he's already winning contracts again. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure.
And it's that sort of dynamic that's the most interesting, because all of a sudden the people who sit outside of these industries who think that they can do better aren't bound by lobbyists. They aren't bound by government politics or bureaucracy, and they don't have the status quo to protect.
Right.
And again, you know, even when you have a look at Google moving into new spaces like healthcare, they have a multi-sided business where they can spend money to build a new business without affecting their $63 billion search revenue, you know, their search business.
Right.
And so on.
Very interesting.
And hence Steve Jobs's phrase, to the rebels, the misfits and the crazies.
Yep. Well, it takes the person that has the ability to think outside of the box and not be constrained by, as you said, you know, all the things that somebody like a Ford would be restrained to because they've spent so much money on R&D for combustible engines. It's hard for them to make that shift, where somebody like Elon Musk comes in and says, I've got nothing to lose here. Let's give this a try. Exactly. I've got the money to do it, and let's give it a try. So,
I've got, exactly. And that's exactly it. It's the, I think I can do better. I've got the money. Because I've got the money, I can get the resources. You know, you can reach out today basically via an email and get access to the world's best X, Y, and Z. And then you need that entrepreneurial flair to be able to start a company, operate it, scale it, and take it to town. And that's what more and more people are doing. Hence, you know, when you have a look at the West Coast, basically where you are, you've got what, 400 multi-billion dollar unicorns, you know?
Right.
If you go and have conversations with the incumbents, basically in the US, whether it's in the banking sector, the insurance sector, the transportation sector, doesn't matter, you know, even government. They didn't see most of these companies coming. And when they did start seeing most of these companies coming, they wrote them off as their titchy little startups that will never be able to get a foothold because, you know, we are the big incumbents. We've got the brand, we've got the capital, we've got the marketing clout, we've got the customers and everything else. And this is where a lot of them increasingly get steamrolled. And they're now trying to learn.
Then they go into panic mode. And
yeah, that's it.
So that's very cool. And I really like the ability and where we're starting to go with solar and the fact that, you know, we've actually created panels that can generate more energy than they absorb. I think that's really cool. But so how do you see something like that applying to smaller devices, say like a cell phone that we always have in our pocket? That's probably not going to be as useful, you know, the solar side of things probably isn't going to be as useful for something like that. Where do you see the battery technology for devices such as a cell phone going? Just as an example, I read about a nuclear diamond battery. Have you heard of those? And what do you think the viability of something like that is?
Interesting, but wouldn't happen because you can't scale it. Just for the listeners, when we talk about diamond batteries, increasingly what we're able to do is we're able to take radioactive nuclear waste, compress it down and pressurize it and turn it into essentially what is literally a diamond battery that has a life of, that's measured in hundreds of thousands of years. You know, it's the battery that will never, ever run out. We can use those same batteries to power pacemakers as well as satellites, basically. So there is a market there. But when we have a look at phones, and again, a little bit like the electric vehicle revolution, there's a lot of different innovations that are coming through. So I work with Samsung. I also work with Huawei. So Huawei have got a team called the 2012 team, which is in permanent crisis mode, not necessarily because of the geopolitics that goes on, but they live in crisis mode because they're always looking for different ways that Huawei can be disrupted. And then Samsung have got a 3,000 strong campus, especially out of South Korea, that is also living in constant crisis mode because they're looking for different things that can be disruptive to their competitors, but also disrupt them. So running through a few, 2 years ago, we produced the world's first smartphone that doesn't need a battery. And there's a couple of ways that we can do that. So this particular one is based on a 1940s spy tech, something called backscatter energy. So there's energy all around us in the air, whether it's, you know, radio waves, whether it's radioactivity, whether it's vibrations. You know, when we're talking, we're kicking off vibrations. That is a form of energy. You know, we are literally flooded in energy. So these backscatter energy systems are able to harvest energy literally from the air because they're able to capture radiation or radio waves and convert it into usable energy. And in that case, we actually created, as I say, a smartphone that worked and it didn't have a battery. We have other slightly more weird technologies coming through. And again, this is where you have to think not of individual technologies, but technologies in combination. This is where we take something like 3D printing, but 3D printing, we can 3D print products at the nanoscale. So if you think about the workings of your inner ear, you've got something called cilia. So the reason why we can hear what other people are saying is because the vibrations hit our ears and the cilia in our ears then process that in a particular way in our brain. And that comes out as sound, or as in my case, blurb. But what we're able to do is we're able to 3D print these cilia, which are like little fine hairs at the nanoscale. So what we have is we have essentially a hairy material. And these are called acoustic batteries. When you talk into your phone, the vibrations from your voice, the vibrations from your movement, it's a little bit like energy harvesting, generates electricity, which runs your phone. So you've got that type of technology. So again, it's kind of like a batteryless phone because really it's not a battery that you're using. It's just this type of nano structured material. But when we start having a look at more traditional lithium ion batteries, we've got a couple of different routes that we're taking. So we've got solid state batteries that are starting to come through, particularly out of Asia. So Japan basically is sort of one of the leaders there. Certain centers in the US basically are sort of trying to catch up. So solid state batteries just are as they sound. They're solid. You know, they'll never catch fire. They're called the Jesus battery because they never catch fire, which is an odd one, but hey-ho. In addition to that, though, we've got bacterial batteries that are coming through. So, for example, we can genetically engineer different bacteria to produce electricity. And they, of course, never, ever run out of electricity or charge. We can use things like photovoltaic materials as well. We can use 3D printed batteries. So if you 3D, again, 3D printing is quite a key manufacturing technology for future batteries. We can 3D print a lithium ion battery. And again, with most batteries, what really matters is the surface area. And you can 3D within a, if you do it correctly, you can 3D print a lithium ion battery that is just a gram in size that has got a surface area that's larger than an American football field. Oh, wow. And from an anode and a cathode perspective, what that means is that you have a very, very dense energy battery. Samsung have used graphene. They've used something called graphene balls, which was about 2 to 3 years ago. They're now commercializing this because, again, you've got to scale this up from a manufacturing perspective. If we use graphene with lithium ion again, bear in mind, graphene also crept up with solar panels. You now have a lithium ion battery that has 500% more charge, but that can charge itself 400% faster. And one of the sort of big problems that smartphone companies actually have is they have a way to produce denser and denser batteries from an energy standpoint. But the computer chips are increasingly drawing more power. Yeah, we're demanding higher power screens and all this sort of stuff. So again, when we have a look at things like consumer electronics, there are a lot of improvements in, for example, energy efficient artificial intelligence chipsets for smartphones, which will be coming out kind of next year. As I say, you know, when we have a look at the future of smartphones and those types of technologies, again, there's plenty to think of. And that's before we start talking about, replacing lithium in batteries. We've got lithium metal ion, we've got lithium sulfur, basically we've got lithium calcium batteries that are coming through. It's quite literally take your pick. And then pushing it out even further, you've got wireless energy. And the FAA recently awarded a couple of new approvals to a couple of wireless energy companies that are now able to throw electricity over a distance of about 15 foot.
Wow. So Tesla was actually onto something, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, in New Zealand, when you have a look at wireless energy transmission, New Zealand, by a company called Enrod, they're the world's first to do this. They've managed to wirelessly transmit electricity across the mountain ranges in New Zealand over distances of tens of kilometers. So now this is where we start getting to the point where today we have a variety of different ways that we can power our gadgets. However, we are starting to get to the point where when you have a look at wireless electricity transmission, in whatever form, whether it's to charge your electric truck, whether it's to charge your toothbrush, you know, all these kinds of things. We can now start talking in terms of a wireless energy internet. So think of electricity being as ubiquitous and being in the same form as Wi-Fi, where you no longer, you know, you don't need to plug in any longer basically to a fixed line broadband connection. You just hook onto the Wi-Fi. We are starting to get to that point with electricity. When you have a look at the attractiveness of that type of technology to energy companies, they've got one option today. They can lay down cables or big overhead cable lines, which cost them hundreds of billions, you know, even trillions of dollars basically in energy infrastructure.
Yep.
Or they can start putting out wireless energy transmission towers along with 5G towers or whatever it happens to be. And all of a sudden, you could flood, say, San Diego in wireless electricity.
Very neat. I would see that. So, you know, obviously there's in somewhere like San Diego, there's already a grid that they've kind of created from an electronics yeah. perspective. But
yeah,
there's a lot of places, as you mentioned earlier, when we were talking, you did some time in Montana, and there's a yeah. lot of places there that are just desolate. And there's, yeah. it doesn't make any sense to run, you know, billions of dollars of wiring to power three houses that happen to be in a small community.
No, so absolutely.
That could change things a lot and yeah. maybe even start to spread people out a little bit more from being so condensed in the city.
Well, absolutely. I mean, yeah, and it's exactly this. So with electricity, we're getting to the point where we were with communications about 5 to 10 years ago. So if you have a look at communications, you know, hooking up a city to broadband is incredibly expensive. You know, you've got to have fiber, dark fiber, you've got to have backhaul networks and everything else. Very, very expensive. So companies like, you know, Comcast or Verizon or AT&T and T-Mobile will spend the money in cities because that's where a lot of their customers are. And when they go to their CFOs and they try to make the business case for doing it, they can say, well, we spend $2 billion connecting up New York, but over a span of 10 years, we'll end up with $20 billion in revenue. You know, you can do the maths.
Right.
But when you start taking that same economic argument, or trying to take that same economic argument to small rural parts of America, and you say, you know, we've got a small township of 200 people. It's going to cost us about $50 million to put in fixed line broadband for them. And over the 10 years, we might be able to claw back, you know, yeah, a million of that if right. we're lucky. The answer is just straight immediate. So with communications, the obvious answer there today is, well, you stick a cell tower in there, basically, or you do long range transmission, or you just now beam connectivity to that place, basically from space. We're doing the same with electricity now. You know, if you say, for example, you were a cabin in the middle of Yellowstone, as we kind of discussed, you don't want to dig up Yellowstone. So why don't I just put in a couple of wireless transceivers, basically, and there you go. That's it. You can power your Xbox games console basically while watching Netflix on 500 different screens and powering up your electric Humvee.
Exactly. Although if you're in Yellowstone and you choose to do that, you're kind yeah. of missing the whole point of being there.
Well, that's it. There you go. But it's green, right? Yeah. So
absolutely.
Yeah. And this is the thing, you know, so we are quite literally at quite an interesting tipping point now in the world of energy and energy storage and generation and all these kinds of things, where the economics of the entire industry are being flipped on its head. The old guard are being kicked to the curb. I remember having conversations basically with Shell, basically about, you know, they wanted to know how to disrupt themselves. And actually, you know, there's lots of different ways. But it took them about 5 years to get to the point where all of a sudden they're buying an electric vehicle charging network basically in Europe for about $600 million. Wow. You know, they sort of...
Yeah. The they saw big it coming oil and gas adjusted.
Companies saw this coming ages, and they just, yeah, but they adjusted in their case very slowly because they weren't necessarily too invested in making this switch happen fast. I mean, look at Saudi Arabia. Right. You think Saudi Arabia wants to turn off Saudi Aramco's oil reserves, which are worth what? You know, as they had a recent $2 trillion-ish IPO. They don't want to turn that monster off.
No, absolutely not.
But now when you have a look at the Middle East, both KSA and the UAE, as well as other areas in the Middle East, they are now trying to diversify their economies because they can see that oil basically is no, and Bloomberg have sort of said this as well, they can see that oil basically is no longer as dominant or as critical a commodity as it used to be, because we're all flipping. You know, right. In Europe, we've now committed to 100%. 100% renewable energy for Europe by sort of 2035. You know, you don't need oil. You know, you need oil to make plastics, but even then, you know, plastics and pharmaceuticals and things. But we're trying to find new ways to make plastics as well. So if you're in the oil business, you know, you're trying to, your lobbying isn't working any longer, you know, exactly. Which then takes us to the, well, we now need to do something different. What will that be? And we get a new bandwagon.
Yep, absolutely. Well, cool. Well, I don't want to take up any more of your time, Matthew. I really appreciate your time here. And I think it's been a really interesting conversation. I hopefully we can do this again. I'm going to try and do more of these more often. So it's just, you know, it, like anything, it's herding cats to get the right people then and the right conversations going and matching the times up. But definitely appreciate you taking time out of your day to talk with me. And hopefully everyone appreciates this podcast and gets something out of it.
Well, that's it. And, you know, that's the aim of this. So hopefully we've changed a lot of people's minds, basically, on the future of energy and electricity and all these kinds of things. That's it. And, you know, it's an exciting, brave new world. That's it. And bearing in mind that when we have a look at electricity generation, that accounts for about 20% of all greenhouse gases that we're throwing into the atmosphere. You know, that starts coming down as well. That's it. So, I'll leave you to go and herd more cats. And great talking to you, Chris. Thank you very much.
It was great talking to you as well, Matthew. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Take it easy, everyone. Ta-da. All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.